So gradually, over a period of time, they began to control greater and greater areas of Greece. By the spring of 1943, with the communists very much playing the dominant role, Ilas, the partisan forces, had 40,000 under arms. And as I say, the communists were basically the people who decided what went. They were the dominant power. What about Italy? Well, Italy, the situation was a little different because, of course, Mussolini had been power since 1922. Fascism didn't come, well, it hadn't in either Greece for that matter. But we have a situation where Mussolini takes power in 1922, establishes a dictatorship in 1926. One of Mussolini's ambitions is to build Italy up as an industrial power. It's very much a second-tier European power compared to Germany. Mussolini has ambitions to build an Italian empire in North Africa, and for that he needs weapons, he needs mechanization, he needs heavy industry. And so in the course of the 20s and 30s, Mussolini destroys working-class opposition, sets up fascist unions, helps to build big factories. Pride of place being taken by the Fiat Mirafiori factory in the northern industrial city of Turin. This, at its peak, occupies 20,000 workers and is seen as a fascist showpiece. So Mussolini, to begin with, establishes obviously solidity at home, but military adventures begin to turn sour fairly quickly. In 1942-43, Italian armed forces begin to encounter defeats in North Africa. And in that situation, the working class, which has been cowed for so long, begins to gather the courage to fight. And it's maybe ironic, maybe not, gravediggers of capitalism after all, the working class that brings forth its own destroyers. We see in March 1943, in the very first big strike in occupied Europe, the workers of Fiat Mirafiori rise up, and before long, there's a strike of 200,000 workers in Turin, sending Mussolini mad with rage, because he had believed that his fascist rule had destroyed the organized working class movement in Italy. And so you see the working class begin to stir in large numbers, with Turin leading the way. But you also see this coinciding with developments on the military front, that with Italy driven out of North Africa by the British and the Americans, are then in a position to invade Italy. And in July 1943, they invade Sicily, with a view obviously to marching north up through the peninsula to drive out the fascist forces and convert Italy into the Allied camp. This situation creates a crisis in the fascist regime, because what we see in this situation then is that the king steps in. The king had appointed Mussolini in 1922 and backed Mussolini all the way, as had the Vatican, as had the army. But in July 1943, faced with military defeat, the king, with the backing of Italian capitalists who are now looking to sue for peace with the Allies, steps in and throws Mussolini out and appoints in his place General Badoglio. General Badoglio, you won't be surprised to hear, is no Democrat. He is a faithful servant of the Mussolini regime. He was Mussolini's chief of staff, in fact, for 15 years, and responsible for war crimes in North Africa. But nonetheless, Mussolini is forced out, and Badoglio and the king then essentially assume power. I say assume power, but in effect, really, they're puppets of the British and the Americans. The British and the Americans back Badoglio, they back the king, who take up residence in the south of the country, in a place, a city called Bari, essentially as a British and particularly British and American puppet government. What happens as the Italian government collapses, as Mussolini's forces fall apart, is the Italian army collapses and disintegrates. Germany, Hitler, fearing that Italy would very soon fall to the Allies, rushes the Wehrmacht, the German army, into Italy. And very quickly, because the Italian army is given no instructions to resist the German invasion, Germany is very quickly able to establish its rule over the northern half of the country. Essentially, all the green areas in this map of Italy are controlled by Germany and the Wehrmacht, directly occupied now by Germany, and through the puppet regime of Mussolini. So Mussolini is tossed out by the king, but he then becomes the German puppet, and he establishes something called the Italian Social Republic, which is basically another fascist regime. In the south, the Americans and British march north from Sicily, and by the end of the year, they control the grey shaded area in this map. And so what you see over the course of 44 and 45 is the battle between the German-occupied north and the American and British occupied South, with the resistance emerging as a major player in this situation, both in the, particularly in the northern parts, particularly in the dark green shaded area, which is the industrial heartland of Italy, which is where the Fiat Turin factories are, for example. So the partisans emerge as a major resistance force. March 1943, at the initiative of the Greek, the Italian Communist Party, which has come out from underground, with the Italian Socialists and the Action Party, sign a resistance pact to form partisan raids on German occupation forces. In September 1943, the National Liberation Committee is set up by the Communist Party, a Popular Front Council, which all the bourgeois parties invited, but they're tiny. Again, they've been collaborators with the right-wing forces and so have very little credibility. It's a left essentially that dominates the CLN, the National Liberation Committee. And it's the Communist Party that starts to establish factory CLNs in the factory to organise resistance in the cities against the German occupation, while the partisans are assembling their forces in the northern mountains and beginning to establish, in some cases, even like partisan republics, driving the Germans out and establishing self-rule for a number of months. Again, it's the Communist Party as a dominant force. They're the people the most self-sacrificing. They are the most resolute in wanting to fight the German occupation. And because they are not tainted in any way by fascism, they are able to appeal to people on the basis of having clean hands. I should also say very briefly, in Italy, there are other left-wing organizations emerge. The Socialist Party and Action Party, for example, both use socialist rhetoric and in some respects are to the left of the Italian Communist Party, but they're much smaller and they don't have the same kind of working class base that the Italian communists gather around them. The Italian communists are also able to capitalize on their association with Stalin. The Russian army is beginning to drive the German occupation of Eastern Europe back, and the Italian communists grow on the basis of reflected glory. We're the party of Comrade Joe Stalin, the man who is freeing Europe from fascism. So we have a situation then where at the end of middle of 1944, everything seems to be up for grabs. There's a situation where I'm going back to Greece now. So you have a situation in Greece where the Germans pull out their forces because they're worried about them being trapped by an advancing Russian army, which has now occupied Bulgaria. Tito's partisans have now conquered Yugoslavia and driving the Germans out there. So the Germans are concerned they get forces in Greece that are going to be trapped by the Russians, trapped by partisans, so they pull them out of Greece. The result of which is then a power vacuum in Greece. The German army was withdrawn. The British army, to whom I'm going to tell you in a moment, to whom Greece has been allocated, the British army is not yet in Greece. They have no forces in Greece. Their armies are in North Africa and in Italy. The Communist Party are the forces in the land. The Communist Party has 350,000 members in Greece by this stage. At last, its partisan forces have 60,000. And ER, the National Liberation Movement, has 1.5 million members in a population of 7 million. Everything essentially was now up for grabs, and the Communist Party, particularly in Greece, had the ability to determine the situation. So when you see the German withdrawal in October 1944, the people flood into the streets demanding real liberation. We don't just want a change of king. We don't just want a change of president. We want to see real freedom, such as Greece has not experienced. And so they come out under the banners of EAR, the National Liberation Movement, and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands march, demanding justice, demanding liberation. This is mid-October 1944. There was then a period then when, as I say, the Communist Party, hegemonic in a resistance movement, can take power into their hands and realise the hopes of the Greek people for genuine liberation. But in what may seem to be a paradox, the Greek communists refuse to move. They refuse to take power. They have control over large areas of rural Greece. Their partisan forces are marching south towards Athens, but they stop. They refuse to enter. They are ordered not to enter the city, even though many of them actually do want to enter the city and conquer Greece and make Greece communist, which was actually the great desire of many Greek people. But the Greek Communist Party orders the partisans to hold out, hold back, rather than take over the city. And instead of taking the city, the National Liberation Movement, tells their supporters, their 1.5 million supporters, to hold out, to wait for the arrival of, quote, our British friends. Their regard to the British, or what they said about the British, was they would be an ally, they would be a reliable friend of democracy, and they could help to purge Greece of its fascist forces led by the pre-war dictator General Metaxas and all the people who followed in his footsteps. This is a timing is everything. For 6 weeks, the Greek communists had control of the situation. The British did not have their army there. The old regime was totally implicated by collaboration with the German occupation, or indeed by just having fled and being cowards. But the Communist Party refused to take advantage. Why was this? Why did the Greek communists refuse to take power? Two reasons. First is that Greece is being allocated to the British camp. The Greek people become the victims of the imperialist carve-up I mentioned in the introduction to this talk. That in 1944, with the German army in retreat, it became obvious to Roosevelt, Churchill and Stalin that Europe was soon going to be, the Germans were going to be driven out of occupation and Hitler was going to be defeated. But who would rule post-war Germany? Who would rule post-war Europe? That's what the big three, Churchill, Roosevelt and Stalin, came together to work out. In the case of Greece, the die was cast at a meeting between Churchill and Stalin in October 1944 in Moscow, the so-called percentages agreement, in which the British, in return for handing over essentially control to Stalin, to Eastern Europe, took Greece. Greece was to belong to the British camp, and Stalin signed off on that and agreed that Greece, and in fact later Italy and other countries, were to lie in the Western camp as part of a trade-off for Russia being given control over the eastern camp of Europe. And so this is actually what was called the percentages agreement. And you can see here Romania, Greece, Yugoslavia, Hungary, Bulgaria, and literally the countries are divided up percentage by percentage between the Russian forces and the British forces. Now, the exact percentage didn't necessarily work out this way, but the general thrust of it was that the fortunes of the mass of people in Europe were to be allocated by tiny numbers of people, in particular these three people, consolidated at the Yalta Agreement in the Crimea in February 1945, the world in their hands. They essentially decided the fate of hundreds of millions of people as a pure imperialist carve-up. This was nothing to do with the war for democracy and everything to do with imperialist spheres of influence. So that was one thing, clearly, that ensured that the Greek communists did not march on Athens. Why? Because Stalin ordered them not to. Stalin had agreed that Greece was to fall into British camp. The communists were not to take power, and they got given very firm instructions to that effect. That's why they held the partisans back. But there was another reason as well. The other reason was their own politics. It's a coincidence, in fact, of the great power concerns and also the politics of the Greek Communist Party, and we'll see later on, the Italian Communist Party, the Popular Front politics. This picture here is of Stalin and a guy by the name of Georgi Dimitrov, who gave a very important presentation or instructions, if you like, at the behest of Stalin, the 1935 Comintern Congress, essentially to replace any idea of the communists fighting for socialism, but instead to restrict their limitations to those of capitalist democracy. And what this meant was that the Greek communists' ambitions were restricted simply to patching up a deal with the bourgeois parties to re-establish Greek capitalism after war. That had been their project since the mid-1930s, and that remained their project. And so when Stalin told the Greek Communist Party they were not to take power in their own right, that essentially fitted together quite well with the Greek communist pre-existing politics. This actually took the form, indeed, in August 1944, of a formal agreement when the Greek communists sat down with the British, sat down with King George II's representatives, sat down with the British puppet government, a guy by the name of Papandreou, George Papandreou, and the Greek communists essentially agreed to subordinate themselves to a new so-called national unity government in which the capitalist forces, the bourgeois forces, the right-wing forces were given way disproportionate influence in this national unity government, and the communists would hold their forces back. And that was what essentially killed off any idea that the Greek communists would actually challenge for power and fulfill the ambitions that millions or hundreds of thousands, at least, of Greeks had, that the communists would now take power, having been the dominant force in resistance and done most to drive back the German occupation. This situation then allows the reactionary forces to pounce. I told you about the 6 weeks. Timing is everything. In that six-week period between mid-October and early December, the British moved their forces by the tens of thousands to Greece and shipped the monarchy and the Papandreou government over from Cairo to Greece to set up camp in Athens itself. So by the 1st of December, the British military commander, a guy by the name of General Scobie, decides he's powerful enough to set an ultimatum to the Greek communists. Remember, the Greek communists are the people, essentially the people who liberate Greece. But now the British are saying, okay, you now have to bow down. And what he tells them is, you have to surrender your arms. But the fascists are able, that is, the people from the pre-war regime and the fascist collaborators during the war with the German occupation, are allowed to keep their arms. The Greek communists, of course, sensibly refuse this instruction. And in fact, they withdraw from the cabinet, the Papandreou government. On the 3rd of December, in protest at this instruction to hand over their arms, they call it a demonstration. The demonstration is enormous, but as out of nowhere, no one's exactly sure who did it. We can only assume it was fascists and fascists and the Greek police force, shoot on the demonstrations, killing 28. That is the beginning of what is called the December events, or the Decembriana. The British have now got their army. They've got their air force in Greece. They launch a strike against the Greek workers' movement and the communists. As I say, the communists have withheld most of their partisans out of Athens. The Athens partisans are small in number. And so the British army, landing their air force in Athens, are able to, with their latest weapons, brought over from North Africa, in fact, brought over from Italy, where supposedly they're still fighting the German occupation. Churchill wanted to fight the prospect of the Greek communists taking power before he wanted to fight German occupation of Italy. And the British basically launched a scorched earth policy against Athens. Churchill tells the army, essentially, treat Athens like a conquered country. And so we see devastation wrought upon Athens, thousands and thousands of people killed by British bombing, by shooting, and by the fascist gangs that the British, the so-called bringers of democracy, bring to the streets of Athens. They essentially unleash the fascist battalions who have been serving the Germans so well for the previous 3 years, and they now set them on the communists once again. I'm not quite sure I can point it out, but on the screen there on the left, you can see this is Churchill piloting an RAF plane and shooting people on the ground. And here you'll see on the right, the British army marching through the working class quarters of Athens. The Greek communists, far too late, begin to fight. But now the initiative has passed over to the British. They had their forces there. The fascists are going on a rampage. And the Greek Communist Party is forced into a defensive position, tries to rally the population. But the RAF are basically bombing people from the air. They're using heavy weaponry to destroy the communist resistance. The result is a humiliating defeat. In February 1945, just 3 months after the Communist Party had the whole of the country in the palm of their hands, they're forced to surrender to the Papandreou government, and particularly to the British, to hand over their weapons. And now the outcome the communists feared in early December 1944 came into effect. The fascist hoodlums basically threw themselves at anyone suspected of being a communist and destroyed the communist presence in Athens. Thousands killed or imprisoned. There was then a subsequent civil war started up a year later, in which the monarchist forces, in which the the government at the stage, increasingly armed by the United States. The Greece is the first stage of the new Cold War, and that the Americans armed the Greek government and the royalists and enable them to wipe out the communist forces, destroying the Greek left, in fact, for 20 or 30 years. It's not until the late 60s and 1970s the Greek left begins to recover. A total disaster and devastation for the Greek left. What's happening in Italy? You remember the British and the American forces are moving north. As they do so, the Germans start to pull out of some of the southernmost towns they've conquered. But as they do so, they launch a scorched earth policy, destroying cities and pulling out whatever manufacturing plant they can. This is a picture here of the damage done to the southern city of Naples as the Germans begin to pull out in September 1943. But very important to notice, they're pulling out ahead of the advancing British and American armies, but it's these people who are the people who actually drive the German forces out. The city rises in insurrection against the German occupation to stop them destroying the city, to stop them drafting the city's young men to serve in the German army or to serve in the German war industries. And you see the common people, the civilians, rising up, guns in hand, seizing off the soldiers, and essentially forcing the Germans to pull out of Naples and to flee north. And you see this happen in town after town. The partisan forces in the cities driving out the Germans rounding up the fascist collaborators and meeting out harsh punishment to those who've made their life hell for the previous 12, 13 years. Not just men, you might have seen in the photograph of the Greek partisans and women, same in the Italian partisans as well. Women take up the fight too. This is very much a popular struggle, mobilizing hundreds of thousands of people. There's a but. Here's the but. The but is the same. The bloody Italian communists do fall in, not so much the same trap, but they fall into the same pattern of behavior as the Greeks. Essentially, because Stalin has allocated not just Greece to the British camp, but also Italy, Stalin basically tells the Italian communists, now recruiting rapidly, now hegemonic in the resistance movement, they too are not to take power. In fact, he sends back to Italy, first of all, he recognizes the Badoglio government and the king, the first government in the world to recognize these fascist leftovers as a legitimate government of Italy. And then he sends Palmiro Togliatti, this chap here, who's already had a disgraceful record in executing and purging anarchists and Trotskyists in the Spanish Revolution. He sends Togliatti out of Moscow back to Italy. He'd been in exile since 1926 to basically redirect the Communist Party in Italy not to fight for power. This is known as the Salerno turn. The Salerno turn, to put it very briefly, because I'm thinking I'm running out of time now, essentially is just the same message as what the Greek communist parties were fed. That is, the Italian communists are not to form power, they're to join a coalition government with the bourgeois parties, socialism is not on the agenda. And so what we see very quickly is that Badoglio, remember, this is a guy the communists have been condemning quite rightly as being a fascist servant, as being a war criminal. The Italian communists now join the Badoglio government, have seven ministers in there, and then in December 1944, when the whole of the North is rising up against the Germans, with the working class guns in hand are chasing the Germans out, they sign a Rome Protocol. The Rome Protocol basically does the same thing in Italy as what the Greeks have done in Greece. That is to subordinate the Italian communists to, number one, the bourgeois parties in their country, which have been insignificant during the war because they've been fascist collaborators in many cases, and then in turn to collaborate the so-called national unity government to the British and the Americans. So they essentially surrender. They surrender without even fighting. They refuse the prospect of taking power. They sell the struggle short and thereby refuse to even try and realize the aspirations of the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Italians who've taken up arms, who've gone on strike, who fought the German occupation, who spent 13 years underground fighting in Mussolini and so forth. And yet the Italian communists throw it all away for a mere pittance, a few cabinet positions in a government led by a fascist servant. And so what we see in 1945 is that the bourgeois party, the main bourgeois party known as Christian Democracy, a tiny and insignificant party during the war that played no role in fighting in the resistance, is built up by the Vatican, by the capitalists, by the British and Americans as to become a big force. Again, it's a matter of timing. The Italian Communist Party allows these people to grow. In fact, they collaborate with them. They regard them as being loyal, anti-fascist, fighters for democracy. These are the people who until recently are being funded by people who until recently have been arming the German war efforts, have been donating to Mussolini, all the rest of it. So the PCI, the Italian Communists, joined the first post-war government along with the Socialist Party, the Action Party and others. Togliatti, the Italian Communist leader, becomes Minister for Justice. Now, does he use this to purge the Italian state machine of fascist collaborators? Not a bit of it. A few heads roll, a few departmental heads are replaced, but by and large, the Italian state apparatus is left virtually intact. A few mayors lose their position, a few, you know, prime ministers or whatever might lose their position. But unless essentially you've been, you know, found gun in hand saluting a picture of Hitler, you're allowed to keep your position. And so the Italian Communist Party collaborate in the restoration of, you know, straightforward, you know, bourgeois democracy in which the capitalists will rule. Togliatti, in fact, actually encourages and facilitates this. He refuses to purge Italian judiciary, with the result that the Communist Party, after 2 years, is thrown out of government at the behest of Italian capitalists and the Americans, again, another stage in the Cold War. And in that period, that two-year period, nothing much is touched about the Italian power structures. The Vatican remains an enormous power, given authority over the education system. A lot of fascists are kept in their positions, and in fact, for decades afterwards. And Togliatti essentially allows the courts to exonerate thousands and thousands of fascist collaborators. The Italian communist resistance fighters, for their part, they're the people that get slung in jail. The fascist judges, now wearing a democratic hat, basically exonerate their fellow pals who've been collaborating with the occupation forces and send thousands of partisan fighters to jail for crimes committed during the war. So all these resistance actions are now regarded as crimes, and tens of thousands of Italian communists are jailed, thrown out of their jobs, victimized, exiled, whatever. So it's not as serious or severe as in Greece, where, you know, by 1948, 49, half a million Greeks have been killed by the right-wing reaction. But nonetheless, compared to the situation, the opportunities the Italian communists faced to thoroughly purge Italian state apparatus of the fascists, to bring about genuine democratic reforms in the country, let alone could they afford for revolution? Let's leave that as an open question. But they didn't even try to fight seriously for reform. They were too eager to basically form this coalition government with a Christian democracy to collaborate with the bosses and to essentially patch up Italian capitalism. So just to finish with these couple of slides here, what can we learn from this whole experience? First of all, World War II was never a war for democracy. None of the victorious powers, the British, the Americans, or the Russians, had any interest in genuine liberation in the territories they controlled. They were willing to team up with fascists and German collaborators to crush the popular resistance movements in the countries they dominated. They cynically carved up Europe according to their own wishes. And a part of the percentages agreement is one of the most obvious examples of this. This wasn't just a nasty Western thing. Stalin was thoroughly implicated in all this as well himself. In order to secure his control over Eastern Europe, Stalin was willing to hand over Greece and Italy to the Western powers, regardless of the wishes of, if like, his own parties, that is, the Greek and Italian communist parties. The majority of his members would happily have taken power, would happily have driven out the fascists. In fact, at one point, the Italian communist leadership, in fact, had to tolerate a whole section of his membership that thought that's what they were really doing. Because had they really tried to crack down and said, no, your job was simply to impose, you know, Italian capitalist democracy, they wouldn't have worn it. So they played out what's called doppiezza, a duplicitous agreement, telling their supporters they're going to fight for socialism, while in fact actually simply patching up Italian capitalism. The other point to say is that the Popular Front politics, the graveyard of struggles, by the Italian and the Greek Communist parties agreed that the struggle for socialism had to be deferred to some point in the future. The only ambition should be the one of establishing capitalist democracy. And of course, in a situation where the communist resistance forces are so strong, accepting that self-denying ordinance, fighting with one arm tied behind your back, only allowed the capitalists to organize their forces and ensure that the outcome after the war suited them, not the working class. The working class were, and peasants were demobilized, and the capitalists were able to impose their agenda instead. So that's the end of a very tragic story. I will just kind of flog this. This is actually a chapter taken from a book, in a book coming out, The Fight for Workers' Power, Revolution and Counter-Revolution in the 20th Century. And you can see here, this little example, this, our story today, anti-fascist resistance in Italy and Greece, is just one part, in fact, of a section about Popular Front graveyard of struggles. So this book actually goes over the history of the communist movement from the First World War, in fact, to the 1950s. Advertising plug over. I would encourage you to, it's just simply a way of saying that the story we're telling here is by no means unique to Italy and Greece. It's part of a pattern by which the Stalinists play a counter-revolutionary role in the workers' movement for four decades, and the way in which they sold the struggles short.